Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Techiana Grassroots Radio. This is your host, Matt Singleton. The song that I just played was by a band that was extremely influential back in my day, and unfortunately, my day is not today. I'm starting to realize I'm getting a little bit older, but basically, that was Pearl Jam, and it was a song called Do the Evolution. And really, the graphics of the cartoon are a lot, you know, more powerful than just the audio by itself, but, you know, this is radio. So, basically, I would say the most destructive political ideology, you know, that is part of human history has been the evolutionary worldview. Now, there are many different titles and many different hats. I've kind of preferred to use, you know, the widest label, and that is humanism. And the humanist worldview, which started back in the 1500s. And on one level, it wasn't that everyone with the title humanist was bad. There are some good humanists. But it's the fact that you can't just pinpoint it to just the atheist. This is kind of man's self-made religion. And sometimes he might want to use the God. Sometimes he doesn't. But it is still the idea that man is on the throne, that man is self-sovereign, and there is no order over that, except for what is made by man. Now, there's a lot of different ideologies that have come about. Most of them politically would fall under the category of socialism. Now, you could argue that there's also anarchism and libertarianism, which would not be in and of themselves socialist, and yet they would agree to the socialist morality system, which then reinforces their generations back into the need for socialism. But basically, today I'm focusing on this concept in this worldview known as evolution. Obviously, it is the overgirding philosophy of science, and popular science pushes evolution. However, the thing that's particularly shocking is the fact that evolution has been debunked many times, and more importantly, that it was fully and obviously well debunked through the 1970s. That means that all of our policies based on an evolutionary worldview were not necessary. You know, I went with Dr. Frank Simon and members of the American Family Association of Kentucky to the Right to Life Banquet. And they had a documentarian speaker, an Irish lady. I forgot her name off of the top of my memory. But she did a documentary on a guy named Kermit Gosnell. What a name. But Kermit was not a frog. He was an abortionist. But he wasn't just any abortionist, or at least we hope he was not just any abortionist. He was also a serial killer. What would happen is that Kermit Gosnell was not, he had gotten a degree, somebody called him a doctor, but he was not registered as a gynecologist. But he got involved with it and started up a clinic in Pennsylvania. It was Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And this clinic, under a Democrat state, was only checked, okay? They only surveyed it one time in 30 years because the Democrats did not want to appear as if they were messing with abortion rights. So as to not appear that they were messing with abortion rights, what they did was, you know, they let them do whatever they wanted. And what was found out was that Dr. Gosnell was having women really mistreated. A lot of people that he would have to perform the abortions on staff had no medical training. And often they would take women and anybody, you know, kind of in their emergency need for an abortion at any time. And sometimes they would dope these women up, massive amounts of drugs. And one time they had a woman who was an immigrant. I believe she was Vietnamese. I could be wrong, but she was Southeast Asian. And basically, you know, she was a small woman, as many of the ladies are from that region. And they overprescribed her medication and killed her. But I don't think that's what took him down initially, or at least what had them search. But he would do a, sometimes he found that it was much easier because a lot of women were getting hurt because of his practices. It was much easier for him to induce labor and have these women go ahead and deliver their babies. And then after they delivered his babies, then he would take the babies and he would kill them. Now his favorite way of killing them was grabbing them by the back of the neck and ramming scissors into the back of their skull and severing the spine from the brain. Sometimes there were incidences where women were sick and vomiting and, you know, all sorts of nasty things, and they would go to the toilet and they would have their baby in the toilet. And a couple of reports of, like, strangling and choking the babies, drowning them in the toilet. 260 babies were born. And after they were born, he would then go about killing them. He had a weird fetish, and he would collect baby feet. And they would store the baby tissue in bags, plastic bags, all over the basement. And the basement, see, what happened was they would find out about it, what was going on, because they said becoming suspicious that he was selling drugs through the clinic. So this is how they eventually found out all this stuff. And when they went down to the basement, the rats were chewing on the baby tissue. They would find large jars full of baby feet because of his fetish for feet. And, you know, just a huge amount of horrific things. They would keep some of the fetuses in refrigerators, the same refrigerators that they would store their food in. So massive amounts of evil and killing. And all this backed up by an evolutionary presupposition that man is not special, that man is just descended from animals and animals had descended from the earth, that everything was materialistic, that man broke down into chemicals. And ultimately, all these values just break down and they get worse and worse and more masochistic over time. So, what if it's all been a lie? Now, let me go ahead, I'm going to show you, and I just have to read this to you. But basically, I'm going to read to you true statements. These are going to be concise, but I've written over 70 articles. In other words, I've written enough space for maybe a dozen books on the topic of creation and evolution. Right? And so, basically, from these, I'm giving you very concise arguments. But this is a quote from a guy named Ernst Haeckel. Now, let me give you a background to Ernst Haeckel. Ernst Haeckel was the apostle of Darwin to Germany. In other words, he was the top promoter of evolutionary, Darwinian evolution, I should say. And he was the promoter of Darwinian evolution to the German people He died later in the 20s. It was kind of like him and Friedrich Nietzsche were the top influences on the Nazi people. Okay? You think of Nazism, you got to think of Nietzsche and you got to think of Heichel as giving them their worldview. Now, he wrote a book, a giant book, called The History of Creation. Now, the worldview of these German Nazis was pantheism. Now, pantheism is not Christian theism, where you believe that there is one God who created the world and all these things. Pantheism is where God is the universe, or the universe is God. The universe is infinite, and therefore the infinity of the universe all comes together into an idea of some sort of divine. It's not a person, okay, but there is a divinity to nature, basically. And he goes through, and I've posted the whole chapter on my blog, biblesmack.blogspot.com. But he goes through and he connects all of the theories of cosmology through geology and biology. And he, you know, basically puts things down, and he has it necessary, and he argues that it's necessary, that life from non-life is part of evolution. Okay? And that's very important because Heichel is the guy who came up with the illustration of what we call the evolutionary family tree. And that is the idea that all life has descended from one source, that we're all connected. You know, an elephant is connected to a tree. We're all related. All things are related. And basically that, you know, life came from non-life, that a cell was first formed, okay? And he would call that spontaneous generation. And he's arguing very strongly for that. And so here's what he writes. He says, if we do not accept the hypothesis of spontaneous generation, says, explain this, life from non-life, then at this point in the history of development, we must have recourse to the miracle of a supernatural creation. The creator must have created the first organisms, or a few first organisms, from which all others are derived. So, in order for evolution to work, all life forms are related. And in order for them to all be related, they had to have started at one point. Now, all this is based on a philosophy called naturalism. Okay? And today, most modernists, atheists, evolutionists, you know, what do? They divide up all their beliefs into different categories so that you can't pin them down on one, even though most of them are consistent with all, okay? And it is, you know, so another title is naturalism. All nature is acting exactly the same at all times. It always was and it always will be, yada, yada. So with this presupposition, it's natural that if all animals are related, they came from one cell, and the one cell must have come from the earth. If they did not, then there must have been a miracle. So there must have been a God who created the life. But if God created one life, then why couldn't he have created all the life? Okay? You see, what's happening is that if you want to deal with real truth and science and facts, you have to understand that when we're talking about history, there is history as far as what people have observed, and then there's this concept of historical science. And historical science is going to take
the ideas of the laws of science and claim that they always were and they always will be, don't ask me why. I mean, if there is no God, if there is no designer, why is there a law that exists? Why is there any gravity? Why does gravity always work? You know, the first law of thermodynamics is that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. Then they'll tell you there's a Big Bang theory in which matter is created. There's no evidence because there's no time that you observe this. Because we have this concept called prehistory. So if there's any authority to this, it can't be because we observed it. Okay? So then where does the authority come from? Well, you have to say, hey, these are natural laws. They always have and they always will exist. So you have to take that leap of faith. So, okay, we'll take that leap of faith. Well, then what do you get? Well, you have a calculation. You have to make all these calculations of what would have happened. You might be right, you might be wrong, but then they have to claim that all this stuff is a fact, and why? Well, he says, look, if we're already having mankind evolve from apes, if we're already having all these different animal species evolve, they have to eventually descend from one source, and that one source has to be spontaneously generated. Because basically you could, and he does admit this in another quote, he does admit that you could have, you know, God create one thing one way, but it's not consistent. Because everything else is, you know, based on this consistent idea. So in order, you know, to have that idea, go with this consistently. So spontaneous generation, according to Earth cycles evolution, has to have spontaneous generation. You have to have life from non-life. Otherwise, then you have to have a creator. Now, Heichel is an interesting guy because, unlike Darwin, Darwin was not, he never graduated with a degree in biology, much less a doctorate. He never published in a peer-reviewed journal. Okay? Darwin's ideas were just popular, and that was it. His only education was theology. Okay, so I've got a better science education than he did. But I digress. So, he said that if we do not accept the hypothesis of spontaneous generation, then at this one point in the history of development, we must have recourse to the miracle of a supernatural creation. The creator must have created the first organisms, or a few first organisms, from which all others are derived. History of Creation, Volume 1, page 348 and 349, Earth Cycle. Okay. So there we have that quote there. And they started working on the idea of a cell. And the cells, Heichel said that they were basically mucus, okay? And most of evolutionary science operated with that assumption. In fact, up through the 90s, and there's even, I've seen, like, websites that were still current that, you know, would say junk DNA, okay? And so there are still claims that most of your cells and DNA would be junk, okay, that are just, there is no purpose or no point to these things. And I'm quoting an article from 1981. And so this is before, or this is with that assumption of junk DNA, that cells are simple. But what's the likelihood that we could get the simple cells, the idea of the simple cells, from non-life, non-living matter. So here's the quote from Nature, which is a peer-reviewed journal. Okay, says the likelihood of the formation of life from inanimate matter is one to a number with 40,000 knots after it. So it's basically 40,000 of yours. It is enough to bury Darwin and the whole theory of evolution. There was no primeval soup, neither on this planet nor any other. And if the beginnings of life were not random, they must therefore have been the product of purposeful intelligence. Remember, I have that quote. The whole quote is part of an article that has been subject to peer review. This is what a lot of evolutionists, when they do the creation debates, they want to argue. They want to say, hey, your stuff is not peer-reviewed. And there's an answer to that. Basically, a lot of creationists have started their own peer-review committees, which should be fine. And the reason that's fine is because there is a system of peer review that's supposed to be objective. In other words, they all look at the article, and then they all test it scientifically, and they all make sure that the math is correct, okay, and that everything is consistent. So basically, here they are in this peer-reviewed journal of Nature, and they go over it, and they see that this guy said, look, that could sink Darwin and the entire theory of evolution. Why could it sink the entire theory of evolution? Because evolution is necessary to be tied up with the process of spontaneous generation, more popularly known as abiogenesis. So basically, the math makes it impossible for a cell to have formed. But remember, that was for a simple cell to form. Since then, we found out that cells are not so simple, but they need to be. They need to be for evolution, as it's traditionally understood, to work. No, the cells are composed of about 1 trillion individual parts. Your average cell is divided up into 1 trillion individual parts. And much of this DNA is grafted together, much like a quilt. And it has layers and layers, usually about 5 layers, that are all stitched together. And all this coded information is perfectly constructed together. You have all sorts of things that have been discovered in the last 30 years since then when we start discussing microbiology. And I'm really not focused too heavily on that just because the initial argument didn't need all that. It doesn't need the ATP motor. That you can break these things down like the flagellum, where the flagellum is working electrically and mechanically. And that basically, when you start looking at these DNA strands, and you start seeing little molecules that are walking up and down the DNA strands to help repair them, when all of a sudden you start seeing all this stuff, it is undoubtedly amazing, if not miraculous, if not supernatural. And yet, it was already impossible if all that stuff was just mucus. Okay? So, essentially, this is enough. All right? The prediction and the failure for the whole evolutionary theory to fall apart. But wait, there's more. And don't worry, I'm just giving you a very brief summary. I'm just giving you the very cream of the crop. Not necessarily even the best, but just, you know how this stuff is going on. Let me take a little break here. I'll be right back. What are you doing? Hello?
All right, now we're back. So, how does the whole thing work out? Well, let's go here.
You have a starting point of what's called circular logic. Now, circular logic is a fallacy. But basically, paleontology, which is the study of fossils, works with geology, the study of rocks, and the two are based upon each other. Let me go over some quotes that kind of talk about that, okay? All right, this is from a textbook called Geology, New York, McGraw-Hill, 1952. The authors are Odie von Ingholm and Katie Castro. They say, I quote, "The part of geology that deals with tracing the geological record of the past, so-called historic geology. Historic geology relies chiefly upon paleontology." Let's remember that again. Historical or historic geology relies chiefly upon paleontology. That's what they say, the study of fossil organisms. The geologist utilizes knowledge of organic evolution as preserved in the fossil record to identify and correlate the lithic records of ancient time. Now, here I'm going to quote another one. This is David G. Kitts, and this is an article, Paleontology and Evolutionary Theory in Evolution, which is also a peer-reviewed journal. September 1974, page 466. But the danger of circularity, remember circular reasoning, is still present. Right? It's still present for most biologists. The strongest reason for accepting the evolutionary hypothesis is their acceptance of some theory that entails it. There is another difficulty: the temporal ordering of biological events beyond the local section may critically involve paleontological correlation, which necessarily presupposes the non-repeatability of organic events in geology. There are various justifications for this assumption, but for almost, and I want you to notice this, but for almost all contemporary geologists, it rests upon the acceptance of the evolutionary hypothesis. So, here you have paleontology relying upon geology, geology relying upon paleontology, and both of them relying upon evolutionary hypothesis. Okay? So, the life from non-life theory is debunked, and the evidence that's supposed to support them, the paleontology and the geology, are actually a house of cards. They are circular reasoning. They're based upon each other, Xing both of themselves out. All right. Now, when we go deeper into this, we have all these species and all this record, and therefore we should find species that are in between, in the middle of development. We should find, because we're assuming that all animals have developed, so that there has to be animals in the middle of this development, okay? We have to be able to find it in the fossils. Stephen Jay Gould, a professor of paleontology at Harvard, he says, "The fossil records, with its abrupt transitions, offers no support for gradual change." That's in the review journal Natural History, June and July, 1977.
And then we have another one. This is from the Museum and Natural History Bulletin. So the Museum of Natural History, David Ropp, he writes in an article called Conflicts Between Darwin and Paleontology, okay, at the Field Museum and Natural History Bulletin in 1979. Here's what they say. Well, we are now about 120 years after Darwin, and the knowledge of the fossil records has been greatly expanded. We now have a quarter of a million fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. The record of evolution is still surprisingly jerky, and ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. So a lot of what Darwin put out has already been debunked by 1979. They have less and less to work with. These are true believers in evolution, okay? Now, a little bit of history when we talk about the dating of things. I'm just reading off of Wikipedia, Geological Timescale. I know Wikipedia's got a bad reputation. It is getting better, but this is just to kind of give you commentary, not to give you proof. When William Smith and Sir Charles Lyell first recognized that rock strata represented successive time periods, timescales could be estimated only very imprecisely, since various kinds of rates of change used in estimation were highly variable. While creationists had been proposing dates of around 6 or 7,000 years of age for the age of the Earth, based on the Bible, early geologists were suggesting millions of years for geologic periods, with some even suggesting a virtually infinite age of the Earth. Geologists and paleontologists constructed the geological table based on the relative positions of different strata and fossils, and estimated time scales based on studying rates of various kinds. And so they have these different processes that they're looking at. Now, the age of the Earth has been growing as far as scientific estimation, and they need it to grow. And I'm going to go into why they need to grow. But, you know, at first it was like a million years, and then a couple million years, and then 100 million years, and then 2 billion years, and then 4.6. And that's just for the Earth. But let me read. This is from Encyclopedia Britannica, 1969, Volume 17, Paleontology, the Succession of Faunas and the Geologic Timescale. Here's what it says. Estimates of the age of various periods very long made on the basis of the minimum amount of time necessary for the deposition of the sediments attributed to them. Since such figures allowed but a few million years for the whole tertiary history of mammals, Charles Darwin and later co-workers were much concerned as to whether all the known evolutionary of life could have been accomplished in the time allowed. So Darwin is concerned that they don't have enough time for evolution to occur. So he's like, hey, we need older ages. So older ages came. Okay. Now, we talk about the geologic column. And this is from the American Journal of Science, volume 276, page 54. It is obvious that radiometric techniques may not be the absolute dating method that they are claimed to be. And this is how we came up with the 4.6 billion years. First, they did that to a meteor, which is kind of weird. But basically, they did it to a meteor. They used to do it to the Earth, and they claimed that it was 2 billion years old, and then they switched over to 4.6. But going back, those radiometric dating methods, okay, it says, back in the quote, may not be the absolute dating methods that they are claimed to be. Age estimates on a given geologic stratum by different radiometric methods are often quite different, sometimes by hundreds of millions of years. that is no absolutely reliable long-term radiological clock. Okay? The clock is this idea of here's our method to determine the age of the Earth. And he's saying there is no absolutely reliable long-term radiological clock. So let's go back to it. We have no historical record. And now when we go into the history of science, we don't have a reliable clock. Okay? That was written by William D. Stansfield, Science of Evolution, New York, Macmillan Publishing, 1977. In page 84, radiometric dating would not have been feasible if the geologic column had not been erected first. So in other words, they wouldn't have a, you know, they're going to say, well, we have a radiometric dating system, and that will prove that the ages of the column are correct. But actually, the radiometric dating system is based on the geologic column to begin with, okay? And it's an article called Pragmatism versus Materialism in Stratigraphy, American Journal of Science, Volume 276, January 1976, page 54. Next quote. In conventional interpretation, the KAR, I think it's potassium argon, age data, it is common to discard ages which are substantially too high or too low compared with the rest of the group or with other available data, such as the geologic time scale. That was by Hayatsu, and then the KR isochronic age of the North Mountain Basalt, Nova Scotia, Canadian Journal of Earth Sciences, Volume 16, April 1979, page 973 through 75. So, what are they saying? They're saying that looking at potassium argon, we just talked about the radiological dating, but also with potassium argon, what do? They keep everything according to the geological time scale. And what's the geological time scale based on? Well, it's based off of circular reasoning with paleontology, which is also based on the hypothesis of life from non-life, which has been mathematically impossible. Okay. Next quote. However, we find geologists often reporting isochron plots which are discordant with the accepted ages of stratosystems. Frequently, these discordant isochron plots date stratosystems much older than even the accepted old ages. Okay, so in other words, we know this stuff goes way off the scale. Remember, they're scaling things in a theoretical world, and the theory is not even matching, and the theory is not even adding up. Okay, let me go back to the quote. I'll start over. However, we find geologists often reporting isochron plots which are discordant with the accepted ages of stratosystems. Frequently, these discordant isochron plots date stratosystems much older than even the accepted old ages customarily assigned to the systems of the geologic column. Geologists should be asking which, if any, of the isochron plots should be accepted as absolute ages, and if the discordance do not falsify the assumptions upon which radiometric dating is based. Okay. Now, let's see here. All right. So, I think that'll be good with that one. You don't really have a strong basis for the evolutionary theory. Now, when you go back to the Scopes monkey trial, most, if not all, the evidence, I have to go back and look it over, but most, if not all, the evidence was not only stuff that we've been able to reinterpret. Most of the evidence was fraud, fraudulent. Our buddy Ernst Haeckel, now, as I said, he was a legit scientist. He discovered 200 different species. Okay, he's a zoologist. That's great. But Ernst Haeckel was also proven to be a fraud when it comes to something we famously called Heichel's drawings. Heichel's drawings were these drawings of embryos. Evolution is supposed to have its change through the embryo, okay, in the womb of the animal. So basically, what he decided to do was show a diagram that he drew up. He was a great cartoonist, but he drew up this diagram, and he had pictures of all these different animal embryos. And lo and behold, they all looked very much alike. They all seemed to be going in the same direction, doing the same thing. Obviously, they must have evolved together. But wait. You see, he actually just did a drawing. Since then, they found pictures of all these different species, and they do not look anything like each other. Kind of look more like their own species. See, that drawing, I mean, Heichel's drawing, that made its way into not only scientific publications, that got its way into scientific textbooks. That was a fraud. That was a drawing. And the sad thing is he's the one with the weight. I mean, Darwin didn't have any degrees in science. Here's the real scientist, and he's making stuff up. And then we have to deal with human evolution. The Neanderthal. There's been a lot of problems with the Neanderthal. Number one, at first when they drew the Neanderthal, what they would do is they'd take the skeleton and they'd say, hey, he was bent over. You see, that's man evolving from the ape, getting slowly taller and walking erect. Actually, no. He had rickets. So it was just a sick Neanderthal skeleton that was bent over. A regular Neanderthal skeleton is just like a regular human skeleton. Then they would hide the original Neanderthal fossil skeletons, and few people would get to see it. They would see their replicas throughout these museums. Well, an orthodontist, dentist, named Jack Coazzo, decided that he would study these fossils, and he wanted to know what was really going on. You know, they've got paleontologists studying them, and here's a guy who studies teeth and jaws, and he said, I want to get a hold of these. Because it was all about that, you know, ape face turning into a human face. So he gets permission to go to France and go to England and go through the museums, find these skulls, find these jaws. And what does he find? Well, he finds that the jaws are specifically protruded. In other words, they're not put in their proper place. They're pushed out a little bit and anchored down so that they appear more ape-like. So then when you make copies of these jaws, you make them appear more ape-like, and then you just draw an ape-like person. So the Neanderthal was warped several times, and since then we found Neanderthal skeletons are thicker. That is true. But they have been found to be people who practice religion, people who practice burial of the dead, people who practice music. So they are human, and they are social creatures just like any other person. They've also since found people with similar eyebrow ridges. So, in other words, it's not impossible. Oh, and they've also found genealogical data that people do have Neanderthal ancestry. So they're people. That's all they were. Then you had the most famous of all hoaxes, which was called Piltdown Man. Piltdown Man was an orangutan jaw wired on to a human skull cap with the teeth filed down. And basically, this sucker, it's been rumored, there's a couple different people
who they've pointed to say maybe he was the one who started this hoax, one of which was Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a Jesuit priest, who is famous for the idea of theistic evolution. He was also eventually kicked out of the Catholic Church as a heretic, and a founder of New Age philosophy. He was a hero among the New Agers. But the Catholics are starting to take him back, thanks to Jesuit Pope Francis. Now, by the way, this is an agenda of socialists and socialism. In fact, there is a book called The Perversion of Knowledge. And in The Perversion of Knowledge, it discusses the field of science in the Soviet Union during the 20th century. And they would have their specific views of evolution, which typically were the more ancient views of evolution. Evolution had to itself, ironically, adapt its theory. And by the way, this is philosophically terrible. The whole idea of science is that if you have an idea and it gets debunked, try another one. Yeah, you could rework your idea, but at some point you got to go to the back of the line. They never go to the back of the line. Why? Because they are a political ideology. They have the money. They have the power. They have the lawyers. They have people in high places. And they force their agenda across. You will be attacked severely if you mess with their power. But I digress. So, Piltdown Man, once again, they didn't really deal too much with the skull after they made copies. And there were, I think it was said, 50 to 500 peer-review articles dealing with Piltdown Man. It was a fraud. So, you know, it makes you wonder how much can you trust the scientific establishment. It was for 30 years that this went on, but it was still discussed. It was still a part of the curriculum of science books in the public school system. I remember there was a, oh man, there was a famous kids show, something about Kramer or something like that, and they would show a display on the wall of the public school, and this is like in the 80s, and they would show Man Evolving, and they'd show Piltdown Man and all these other groups. And basically, they would get through with all these different fraudulent skeletons. Well, now they were just drawings, but basically, like it was a famous movie because the kid drew his bully and said, you know, he's right there on the evolutionary scale. But that's not the big deal. When I was in the sixth grade at Stewart Middle School, I was taking a science class. My teacher, I remember her name, was Miss Parks. There was another teacher there. And I'm just giving you my recollections. But I remember this was in the science textbook. Now, what they used to do is they'd have you read the textbook. You could not keep your textbooks. They would take it back. And they'd redo it every couple of years, which also made this fraud a whole lot easier to do by the government. But there was a question about Piltdown Man. And, you know, one of the teachers was like, was explaining to me, like, yes, this is a link to evolution. This is true. Piltdown Man is a relative. And one of the assistants was like, and then she's like, it's okay. So, you know, that's what happened. But basically, you know, that was in 1991, 40 years after it was discovered to be a fraud. I remember when I was 18, there was a kid. Now, he was going to Catholic school, but, you know, I said something about Piltdown Man, and he was like, I don't like that, you know. Then they find out that was a fraud, and I was like, no, look, you can't, you know, I was saying I don't believe in evolution, but I'm not going to argue against the evidence, because I was taught that that was evidence. But to me, it didn't matter, because animals and people can have mutations. It doesn't mean that they've left the species. It just means that there's a freak. Okay? And I used to, and this is kind of weird, but basically my mom was a public school teacher, and I would help out with a kid who was in elementary school, and he had a lot of disabilities. And I read to him a book about freaks and all these circus freaks and all this kind of stuff. And the idea of it, he seemed to kind of like it, actually. But basically, it was just this idea of, like, you know, other people with deformities and how they had to get along with it and what they did. And so I would, you know, go over this stuff with him. And it got me thinking. And I'm thinking, hey, you know, just because you have one fossil does not mean that you proved that everybody came from fossil A, B, C, or D. And there's a famous creationist named Kent Hovind, and he'll say it like this. If there is a hamster buried below your grandpa's casket, it does not figure that that's your great-great-grandpa. He said, a fossil does not prove who they are related to or if they had any kids. A fossil is just a skeleton in the ground. You don't know what the relation is. You don't know who they're related to, and you don't know who they were going to pass their generation on to. So you really can't, you know, make that assumption. Human evolution has been interesting because it is so forced. It is an area of conspiracy because you have fraud after fraud after fraud. Many of these I don't have time to go over all the way through. You have Lucy. Lucy was a major evidence for evolution. But the kneecap of Lucy, which was the human-looking part of Lucy, was actually found a mile away. Might not be exact, probably more than a mile away. But basically, the rest of Lucy matched up with a type of ape, okay? And probably chimpanzee-like, like a breed. And then when they would make take it to, like, the, I think it was St. Louis Museum. In St. Louis, they have a display of Lucy, and they draw her as a fully functioning ape human creature. The fossil has no feet, so they draw her with human feet. And they make them look more human, and they give them human eyes, and they give them, you know, some humanoid abilities and stuff like that. And these are just based on imagination, but they want people to get that idea. And I saw a recent thing where in that display in St. Louis, they admit that this thing might not be the most accurate, but we wanted people to get that impression. They want people to think that people are related to apes. Problem there is that as late as 2002, I don't think I've got the quote on me right here, but there is a peer-reviewed journal where they admit that the they don't have any fossil evidence that links, there's no intermediates that link chimpanzees to humans. By the way, Charles Darwin himself
was assuming that we were related to the orangutan. But now, you know, I think Richard Dawkins would agree with this, they argue that we are not related to any living species. No. They argue that there is an intermediate species, which we've never found to exist, that both apes and humans are related to. So the evidence for this is zip. They've argued for, and here's another thing. One of the major arguments that a lot of guys have recently been talking about is they've always found people and apes in the right geologic strata and stuff like that. But actually, they haven't. They found this a long time ago, and I guess, you know, some of these guys, they don't like to keep reading the old material. You know, when they find evidence, we can forget the evidence if nobody talks about it. It's called The Lady from Guadalupe. Not Our Lady of Guadalupe, that's Mary, sort of, not really. But anyway, but The Lady from Guadalupe, I'm going to read to you from a book called Darwin and the New World Order. It says before, let's see here. It is appropriate at this point to introduce the Lady from Guadalupe. Since this was a well-authenticated discovery, widely reported in the scientific journals of the day, and on display at the British Museum for more than half a century, it's Koenig, 1814. The discovery was made in 1812 on the coast of the French Caribbean island of Guadalupe, and consisted of a skeleton fully human in every respect, complete except for the feet and the head. It was identified as that of a healthy woman about 5 feet 2 inches. Of importance was the fact that although many of the bones were twisted and joints dislocated, and the skeleton was fully articulate, every bone was in its proper position. This vitally important feature is undoubtedly the reason for the specimen not now being on display at the museum or mentioned in the textbooks today. The limestone in which the skeleton was embedded was extremely hard and part of a formation more than a kilometer in length. While according to modern geological dating, it is 28 million years old. A normal human fossil, supposed to be 28 million years. Now, she was part of a strata that was over a kilometer long. It was one geologic body, okay? And this skeleton was stuck inside it. And it was a strata that's 28 million years old. Human evolution was supposed to take place within 2 million years. We're supposed to have these intermediate species and everything going back in the last couple hundred thousand years. How did you have a normal human 28 million years ago? Now, let me read a caption here. The lady from Guadalupe discovered in Mycenae limestone was fully reported by Koenig and illustrated by this engraving in the prestigious Philosophy Transactions of the Royal Society, London, 1814, Science and Medicine, Library, University of Toronto. And another place you can look up, don-lindsay-archive.org, the Mycenae human fossil in Guadalupe. Now, basically, that disproves human evolution, okay? Well, there's also another factor, which I guess I'll mention real quick, and that is that people have heard the old 98%
okay, that 98% of, I don't think it was DNA, or the chromosomes. Well, basically, I think they say 98% of human chromosomes are matching 98% of chimpanzee chromosomes, or DNA. Basically, the problem there is that that was done in the 90s before they even mapped the human genome. Okay, they didn't even have things fully together. That was dealing with similar DNA. In other words, like, oh yeah, let's take that little piece of a chimp's nose with a human nose, not really comparing the whole body and the parts that don't match and all that kind of stuff. And the fact that when you look at DNA, relation doesn't matter because it's coded information. You know, I could probably find a lot of similarity between the Holy Bible and the Satanic Bible as far as vocabulary. Doesn't mean that they have the same message. You know, if I studied a million different disciplines and believe that there is a God, it wouldn't be a huge difference from me saying that I've studied the same amount of disciplines and found out there isn't a God. It's only about two or three characters. So similar code is like similar information, but just a letter or two can change the meaning and definition of the information. So, once again, we're kind of stuck back to this principle. We've known in the scientific journals, we've known in deeper scientific evidence, evolution has been debunked. That the only reason for it is for the political ideology. All of our views on sex, all of our views on morals, our views on life, our views on socialism, and instead of the citizens, the masses, the idea that humans, we don't have to respect their wills, and so much of this stuff all goes back to the evolutionary worldview. Yet the science is just not there. I'll see if I can put a link up to my resources, the Biblical Historical Science links, which is, let me see here real quick, I can find it, November of 2015, www.biblesmack.blogspot.com. One more time. I'll just put it out here real quick. Okay, Biblical Historical Science Links, November 21st, 2015. You'll find over 70 articles and videos and stuff like that. www.biblesmack.blogspot.com. And you can check that out. All right, well, I will catch you later on Kentuckiana Grassroots Radio.